It is 10:01, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany, and you can find us on the web at www.kboo.fm.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the River City Bluegrass Festival, taking place January 9th through 11th at the Oregon Convention Center. The festival is a benefit for the Ethos Music Center. The festival will host a wide range of acts including Daly and Vincent, Sierra Hall, Longview, Cadillac Sky, Daryl Anger, Tony Furtado, Jim Queskin Jug Band, and many more. There'll be jamming and workshops as well. That's the River City Bluegrass Festival, January 9th through the 11th at the Oregon Convention Center. More information is available on the web at www.rivercitybluegrass.com.
And coming up this morning on KBOO, next, host Michelle Schroeder Fletcher speaks with Luke Walden, co-author of The Narcotic Farm, The Rise and Fall of America's First Prison for Drug Addicts. At 10:30 on Sounds of Awareness, the topic is durable medical equipment and taxes. The guest is Tom Coogan of Care Medical and Rehab. At 11, it's Air Cascadia, news and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. And at 11:15 on Flashpoints, hear updates on the killings and destruction in Gaza. Stay tuned to KBOO.
And I'm Michelle Schroeder Fletcher, speaking to you from KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. And today we have with us in studio documentary filmmaker and co-author Luke Walden of a new book this fall called The Narcotic Farm, The Rise and Fall of America's First Prison for Drug Addicts. Good morning and welcome to Portland.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Yes, for our listeners, we'll be pleased and interested to know that Luke just moved here with his wife and his daughter from New York. And before we talk in detail about the book, The Narcotic Farm, let's talk a little bit about how this commingled and came about, because there's also a documentary film.
Right. It's an interesting story how the book came to be, because it really came out of a confluence of two different strands of research. My filmmaking partner, J.P. Olson, had been researching for the documentary, and I joined him in the project. And so for several years, since 2003, we were interviewing former patients at this prison hospital, and we were trying to find visual evidence for the documentary. So we were hunting for boxes of photographs and old cans of film in people's garages. And so it was a visual and an anecdotal approach to trying to capture the history. And at the same time, our co-author in the book, Dr. Nancy Campbell, who is a professor of the history of science at Rensselaer Polytechnic in New York, she was researching for her own book, which is an excellent scholarly history of the scientific research that took place at this prison hospital. And that book is called Discovering Addiction. And we interviewed her as our expert historical interview subject for the film to try to understand what was going on in the research lab there. And as time went on, we realized we had enough visual evidence that it would really make sense to present it as a book. We heard a lot of stories of boxes of photographs that got away. One man had all of the intake cards with all the mugshots from the prison, and nobody wanted them, so they're gone. But we were also able to find in many different archives real treasure troves of visual evidence
about
this place. Which
is clearly evident for anyone who picks up the book. It is absolutely visually stunning in its representation of this particular moment in history and how that chronicled. It's really, really interesting.
Oh, thank you. We weren't sure what we would find, and we were pleased and surprised to find good photos and film even in the National Archives and the Library of Congress. The real treasure troves were preserved by individuals who were employees. It was a federal institution, and so there were federal employees who, in some cases, worked there for decades. And when the place was closing in 1975, it opened in 1935. When it was closing in 1975, there was a sense among some individuals that this was a history that would be lost.
Yeah.
And so people carted off boxes. One nurse named Sydney Lewis preserved 8 cartons of photographs and donated them to the Kentucky Historical Society, which is where this institution is located. It's in Lexington, Kentucky.
And with that in mind, let our listeners know, because this is a very unique to this particular facility, it was a penitentiary, but it was also a research and drug rehabilitation. So walk us through, first of all, the location, which is just stunning in itself.
It's a complicated history. It's and a nearly unique institution, certainly unusual. It was opened in 1935 with a congressional mandate to be the nation's center for the incarceration, rehabilitation, and also scientific study of drug addicts. So it was a prison, it was a hospital, and it also had a research laboratory. So it had a tripartite purpose. And that hybrid nature, I think, in some ways says something about how we're still struggling with this issue.
Our very ambivalent and schizophrenic view of drug addiction, period.
If we could play the first clip, I think that speaks to that.
Sure. Todd, if we can play the first clip.
This is from the documentary, The Narcotic Farm.
Right.
And this is archival film and one of the former patients talking.
Okay.
When the United States Public Health Service Hospital was established in Lexington, Kentucky, the problem of narcotic drug addiction was put under the banner of medicine. Until that time, this problem had been regarded almost solely as a correctional one.
Lexington was a prison and a hospital and a symbolic and literal expression of America's schizophrenia about how to treat addiction. Is it a medical problem, a social problem, a criminal problem? What is it?
I think that ambivalence and uncertainty persists today.
Today, absolutely.
And one of the things that's interesting to me about this project all along the way was that the issues were the same in 1920, in 1935, in 1950, as they are now. And it's a problem that we continue to struggle with. So if I could just set up what the place was intended to do. Not many people know this, but heroin addiction goes back to the turn of the century. The Bayer company of Bayer Aspirin marketed Bayer heroin in 1898 as a cough medicine. And it was rapidly recognized that this was a very addictive pharmaceutical, and so that was controlled. And that was part of a trend towards increasing control of drugs, food, all sorts of substances that you ingest at the beginning of the 20th century. And as new drug laws got increasingly harsh and strict, federal prisons began to fill up. So that between 1910 and 1925, the federal prison population increased sevenfold. So it was a big prison overcrowding problem. And about half of those people were there for violations of new laws, many of them drug laws. So prison wardens hated these people. They felt that they were troublesome prisoners. They were always trying to smuggle drugs into the prison. They were turning on the other inmates.
And not to mention, as it's shown in the documentary, a lot of the going cold turkey, they all of a sudden were in a quasi-medical facility where the rest of the, like you said, the inmates were...
Yeah, as one of our interview subjects, who was a farm administrator at this institution, said, drug addicts are different than your regular prisoners. When they're in withdrawal, they're psychopathic, they're ill, they're desperate for drugs, they're just harder to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And so prison wardens wanted them out. So on the one hand, there was this problem on the enforcement side. Where are we going to put these people? And on the other hand, at the same time, in the progressive era, there was a dawning realization that drug addiction might not be a moral failing that people had control over.
And that was a surprise in the movie, how there was, I was kind of taken aback at a rather compassionate, progressive view of drug addiction and the people involved in it.
Very, and that's one of the ways in which the story is consistent with today. I think the history of addiction and addiction treatment is strangely ahistorical. We tend to feel like we're discovering it for the first time this decade, with each new wave of a new kind of drug or new addiction. But doctors in the 20s were beginning to think that this was a disease that could be treated medically. And if it was a disease, it should be treated with compassion. And in particular, Dr. Lawrence Kolb, who became the first director of the institution, really espoused this belief. And so the institution had a hybrid bureaucratic nature. It was run jointly by the Bureau of Prisons, who were in charge of incarcerating federal convicts who were drug addicts. So it was a kind of quarantine for people in the federal prison system. And it was run by the U.S. Public Health Service, who were in charge of compassionately, medically trying to rehabilitate these people, give them some care, help them get over their addiction so that they could go back out and be productive, happy citizens. And so, you know, former inmates who we talked to always said, yeah, it was a prison. Well, it was more like a hospital than any prison, but it was more like a prison than any hospital. They felt confined. They also felt that they were very well taken care of. So that's part of how it got started.
And again, what was unusual is part of its mandate was designed to rehabilitate. I mean, that was in its inception, which was a really, I think, progressive, far-reaching thought.
It really was. And it's the nature of the institution is true to a lot of progressive era ideals. It's in Lexington, Kentucky, because of ideas about what was called moral therapy, which was if you have people who are suffering from a social problem, you know, people considered addiction an urban problem. It was an urban blight. It spread like a contagion teeming ghettos. If you could get them out to the country, if you could get them working on God's green earth, under the sun, learning wholesome country values, breathing fresh air, this in itself would rehabilitate them. They would become better citizens. And so that was an old belief that was prominent also in the progressive era.
And I would say in reading the book and viewing the documentary, one of the interesting things is one of the main characters in the book is the farm. The institution itself is fascinating and beautiful. In the front cover of the book, people will see that it has the leisure cows, and like you said, the landscape itself feels different than what you think of when you think of heroin addicts. And anyway, it was very
definitely
evident.
And most of the inmates who we interviewed had come from big cities. They were in a fantasy land. They had never seen these rolling green blue grass hills, you know, these herds of cows. It was a beautiful landscape. The institution was designed with gigantic windows because the idea of being able to see the landscape and see into the distance was also supposed to be sort of morally soothing and rehabilitatory. It was, in some ways, it was like a monastery.
Right.
You know, and you can see that in the architecture in the photographs. It has a Romanesque arcade running around the courtyard. You almost expect to see monks in robes, you know, doing their penitence around the outside of the courtyard. And it had that kind of sanctified physical manifestation.
Yes.
Because of this goal of moral
rehabilitation. Well, I tell you, it was stunning for those of us who have kind of an urban background to, like you say, recognize that there's parts of that seem really sacred and important and healing.
Mm-hmm. And it became it was an interesting place. It became, we think of addiction as an urban problem, but in the middle of the 20th century, in some ways, this place in the fields in Lexington, Kentucky, became the epicenter of addiction culture. You know, people went there to be rehabilitated, and they were put to work on the farm, which was a vast operation. It had 1,000 acres. You know, they could produce 1,500 gallons of tomato juice in a day during the tomato harvest. They made all the pork and beef products that for the institution. It was a self-subsisting institution. They were learning trades in the auto shop or in the needle trades. They were learning to do construction.
I think we need to remind our listening audience, too, that this was both a prison in which there was involuntary, you know, as part of your sentence, you could do it. But interestingly enough, this was also a voluntary place. So people could, from across the country, and you have one character that... one gentleman who goes through his entire the process
right.
of voluntarily committing himself, a young man, a really young man.
And this was also part of its congressional mandate. There was no other drug treatment available. And when you're a heroin addict, you have no options. The only purpose in your life is to score. And so if that means stealing from your family, if that means, you know, stealing somebody's purse, if that means burglary, you'll do it. And people would get desperate. People who wanted treatment couldn't find it. In New York City, the only place you could go to try to dry out was check yourself into a jail and kick cold turkey on a cold jail cell. Lexington, Kentucky, where this institution was, the narcotic farm, it had a reputation as a great place mm-hmm. to detox.
Mm-hmm.
There was a compassionate, gradual reduction of the amount of opiates that you were addicted to. There was great medical care. One part of the therapeutic enterprise was that people needed help medically. Being a heroin addict is hard on your body. It's particularly hard on your teeth. And the place was renowned for its dental work. People would go there, and you know, and they kept records in 1 year. And I think 1937, they extracted 4,000 teeth. It had great dental work. It had great medical care.
Yeah, they're on page 82. I was mm-hmm. Noting that it said the continuous flow baths were used to quiet and soothe the nerves of patients in withdrawal. One published account noted that the soothing talk of the controls operator is almost as effective in reassuring the sufferer as the flow bath itself. And then there's a picture of 1939. It was fascinating. I mean, again, I think we have forgotten that this concept of this being a really difficult medical condition, we tend to, you know, since the war on drugs, mm-hmm. hence war, just say no, and all the other things that have permeated the culture that we live in today, this is really a wonderful account of a different way.
It's certainly different from how it's done in prison today,
yeah.
you know, and how drug treatment is done today. You know, and this story has been forgotten. Almost no one knows about it now. At the time, it was incredibly well known, and it featured in a lot of popular culture. I'd like to play the second clip that we have, which is an excerpt from the Frank Sinatra film, The Man with the Golden Arm.
Yeah.
And this should give you an idea of how well known the narcotic farm was. I mean, this is Frank Sinatra. It doesn't get bigger than this.
Yeah.
How was it down there, Frankie?
Greatest place you ever see, Vansy.
She means Lexington.
I'm telling you. Ball games, great food. I even learned how to play the drums.
Yeah. You make it sound as if I missed something by not going to jail years ago. It's a prison, no?
More hospital kind. It's Dr. Lennox who took care of me down at the hospital. Real good guy. He told me at least 10 times. He said, Frankie, when you get out of here, you take even one fix, you're hooked again.
And so, I
need to interject. Of course, in the documentary, it was fascinating that there was this clip, and then further down, they showed, of course, the gentleman who had been released, and to a person on the way back.
Yeah. And
this is what they were planning,
right? And this is the big failure of the
dilemma.
Place.
Yeah.
The dilemma, and the reason why I think it was forgotten is that. In terms of therapy, it never really worked. It sounds great. It was really compassionate. People loved it. People would volunteer, but they would volunteer again and again.
Mm-hmm.
They would go. They would check in. They would get their medical treatments. They would detox, and they would go back out. And even if people stayed for a 5-year sentence, the federal convicts who were there, almost to a person, 93% went back to using drugs almost immediately after they left the institution. And this problem, why are these people going back to the drug years after they're physically dependent?
Yeah.
They're not in withdrawal. What's going on? And this was a key question that the research lab set out to try to answer.
Brings us to the next really relevant and important point in the book and the movie is because, again, there starts to seep into my historical information Kennedy, and now we get to the research part and the Tuskegee institution, and now there starts to be an updating that most of today's culture remembers. So
right.
Now talk to us about the research part.
Well, the research lab was called, it was there from the very beginning in 1935 when the institution opened. From the mid-40s, it was called the Addiction Research Center, and that's how it's widely known today. And it was a small lab within the larger institution. Where federal convicts who were doing long sentences, could volunteer to participate in drug experiments. And it had an elite, small but elite group of government U.S. Public Health Service scientists who were really trying to, they had a twofold mission. One was to try to understand the basic mechanisms of addiction. What is this problem? Why do people get addicted in the first place? Are there certain kinds of people who are more prone to being addicted? Why do they keep going back to it after they've detoxed? How does it even work? What's the drug doing in the body? So those were really basic science questions about addiction that they were trying to understand, with the eventual goal of hopefully trying to find a cure for it. And then the other goal that evolved was a public health mission, and that was to try to identify new drugs that might be addictive before they could be released on an unsuspecting public. You know, I mentioned before that heroin was originally a cough and pain pharmaceutical that was, you know, administered to women and children in the turn of the 20th century. They were really trying to prevent that sort of thing from happening again. And so they had this captive population of eager volunteers.
Eager and willing.
And so this became the center. You know, this was years before the FDA is what it is
today. Right, right.
There was no other program for trying to assess addiction liability of new pharmaceuticals. And so the Addiction Research Center was it. And those were the two main purposes of the lab. Maybe we could play clip number three. I think that'll give you a sense of some of the inmate experience. And you'll also hear a archival narrator from a film that was produced at the lab.
Okay.
This motion picture was filmed at the Addiction Research Center in the early 1950s.
It would get you hooked on some good, pure heroin, man. And they kept you hooked for a long, long time. Then all of a sudden, boom, you had a kick cold. And they would just observe you and take notes and whatnot, like, you know, like a lab rat.
This scene shows a subject at the beginning of the study experiencing the acute effects of morphine. He is relaxed.
The guys who were in there loved being there because it was a better way to do time than being in population. I mean, would you rather lay around in your pajamas and wait for some kind of dope to be shot into you or work on the farm?
And I think that sort of sums up the inmate experience of it. You know, this whole institution is a hybrid, it's complicated, and when you're thinking about it, my partners and I, we sort of experienced it as going through the looking glass. You know, when we first heard about this research lab, we expected this to be another Tuskegee syphilis experiment, a story of experimenting on unwilling, unknowing federal prisoners. And what we found was just the opposite, which was that lots and lots of people wanted to get into these experiments. And they were volunteers. They signed consent forms. They were aware of what they were getting into. Now, you know.
It was great that you made it current. You talked about LSD, and there started to be some questionable as it evolved.
Yeah.
That most people might. I think we need to touch on that before we run out of time.
Sure. You know, people volunteered, and for the most part, patients thought that the research program was a good deal.
Right.
In retrospect, some of the people later began to think, you know, I was a prisoner, I was a drug addict, and, you know, in some ways...
Was I really competent to make that kind of decision?
Right.
Yeah.
I was, you know, maybe I was used in some way. And one way in which, you could really make that argument is that up until 1955, one of the incentives for participating in the research was that after you completed the research experiments, you could be paid in a certain number of doses of your drug of choice. And so, you know, it's easy to say, well, this is like offering candy to a baby.
Yeah.
You know, a drug addict, does a drug addict really have a choice?
Competency, yeah.
Many of the former inmates who we interviewed who spent, you know, 40-year careers as addiction treatment counselors after they finally got themselves clean looked back on it and saw no ethical problem
right.
with it at all.
Right, which was a real testimony. Because they are mm-hmm. in drug treatment. You go on to mm-hmm. follow them, and they're in drug counseling mm-hmm. and treatment themselves in terms of counseling and overseeing.
Right. Let's one former inmate later came to feel that he had been used, and I think he came to feel that partly by his experience in Senate hearings in 1975. If we could hear clip five.
Yes, we'll hear that. Thank you.
Why did you participate in the testing program?
For the simple reason that there were some drugs, and I wanted them. The payoff not only was in drugs, but it was also in time. You had a choice of earning days on the time that you were doing there, or you could get paid off in narcotics. I choose narcotics.
What did most of the other patients choose, narcotics or time off?
The majority of them choose narcotics. You were dealing with drug addicts. I mean, that's what they wanted.
Some of our listeners will recognize Ted Kennedy sitting on it. It's a fascinating clip. I don't want to run out of time before I remind our listeners who I'm talking to. I'm speaking today with Luke Walden, who's a co-author of the book and a documentary film director. The book and the film by the same name are The Narcotic Farm, The Rise and Fall of America's First Prison for Drug Addicts. And you have a website.
www.narcoticfarm.com. You can get more information about the book and see some photographs from the book. And also we try to post information of when the film screens. It's sort of in the ether on public television right now. It comes and goes. And
yes, but it has been screened.
It's been screened on public television in November, and hopefully it'll come back around for another cycle.
Yeah, well, that'll give people a cause to push for and everything. Is there anything that, you know, we've just got a few minutes and I want to, I mean, I was just taken by, like I said, the visual, which is the core of the book.
Well, I think that's right. For me, the thing that's most interesting about the book is that it's really a visual history. It tells the story in pictures. We managed to select about 150 of the most compelling out of maybe 2,000 photographs that we found that really tell the story. And so it's, I think, an unusual history. I think the thing I'd like to say at the end is that this... the history of the narcotic farm really exemplifies what our first former patient said, which is that we have a schizophrenic attitude towards this problem. The current definition of addiction is that it is a disease, a chronic relapsing brain disease. That's what the federal government says. And yet...
we treat it.
The DEA and enforcement also are mandated by the government to treat it as a crime.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had the ballot measure 61 and 57 just in the fall here in Oregon, where we're wrestling with that issue. Are we going to give treatment to people? Where are we going to give treatment? Should we have mandatory minimums? And I think that the challenge continues.
Absolutely, absolutely. Four days ago in the paper, front page about Parsons, who was WAMU's chief executive, and on the front page, it says, while Parsons, whose incarceration is not related to his work for WAMU, oversaw a team screening mortgages and applications, he was snorting methamphetamines daily. In our world, it was tolerated. A person who worked for him and recalls seeing drug paraphernalia on his desk. Mm-hmm. This is an issue that's ongoing, and of course, this chronicling it in The Narcotic Farm is from 1935 to 1975. Just a really interesting historical cultural perspective. I really was fascinated by the work, and I'm so glad that you're in Portland, able to join us. Again, I've been speaking with Luke Walden, and his book is The Narcotic Farm, The Rise and Fall of America's First Prisons for Drug Addicts. Wonderful documentary. We're hoping to see it come back around. And the website one more time?
www.narcoticfarm.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much. You've been a wonderful guest, and this is just a fascinating and interesting interview.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to talk.
All right. This has been Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher at KBOO 90.7 FM Portland.
And coming up next on KBOO on Sounds of Awareness, the topic is durable medical equipment and taxes. The guest is Tom Coogan of Care Medical and Rehab. Stay tuned to KBOO.
Hello everyone, welcome to Sounds of Awareness. In this half hour, we